Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Vice and Folly at Home and Abroad. We'll hear about Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, and worse. We'll hear from William Bloom, David Rovics, Glenn Ford, and yours truly. I hope you'll stay tuned. As I speak, it is March 2016. You may have read in the press that the election carnival is well underway. What really strikes me, and not for the first time, is how right Noam Chomsky is most of the time when he talks about U.S. domestic and international affairs. Chomsky has repeatedly said that any dictator would be envious at how well the powers that be get the U.S. press to unanimously parrot the official line on every issue, regardless of the First Amendment, and despite the absence of government censors. How do they do it? I think of Chomsky every time I open up my daily newspaper. That's the former Manchester Journal-Enquirer, now the Journal-Enquirer of No Fixed Address. For months now, 90% of the paper's op-ed essays, and many of the editorials, and nearly all of the editorial cartoons, have been on this theme. Trump is no good. The Republican Party establishment must stop Trump. The American public must reject Trump. And every other newspaper I've looked at, including the New York Times, is doing the same thing. Now, I personally have no love for Donald Trump, and I have still less love for most of his Republican competitors, or for Hillary Clinton either. And I also have a serious disagreement or two with Bernie Sanders. So what I am saying is not partisan. I'm no fan of Trump. Still, I'm struck by the total unanimity of all published opinion here, and I'm struck by the total disdain for democracy that all the columnists are displaying. Not even lip service for democracy. Huge numbers of citizens are rallying behind a candidate that the establishment does not control, and the press is screaming for established power to do something to stop the will of the majority, or at least the will of the largest plurality, to stop it from being honored. Paul Krugman wrote a good analysis of the Republican side a couple weeks ago. Let me paraphrase. Trump is a scam artist, but all the establishment-approved Republican candidates are scam artists. For decades, government policies of both parties have consistently damaged white working-class citizens. Black and brown citizens, too, of course. But beginning with Nixon's Southern Strategy, so-called, the Republicans successfully pulled the angry working-class whites into their party, appealing to whatever racism, sexism, and homophobia these voters had, and also appealing to these voters' real, accurate fear of economic devastation and political powerlessness. The party then tossed the crowd a few bones. We'll attack Planned Parenthood, say. Then they continued to implement policies that further impoverished the working class and further enriched the investor class. Well, you can fool some of the white working class some of the time, but you can't fool all of the white working class all of the time. And more of them have been catching on. All the so-called respectable establishment Republican candidates want to abolish Social Security and Medicare, make medical care even harder to afford. They want to cut taxes on the rich even more, privatize everything, and start even more wars against more countries. But Trump apparently is not taking these stands. Not all of them, anyway. Trump is running his own scams, but they're not the scams that the Fortune 500 want run. So, Trump must go. He's interfering with the success of the establishment's own scams. So says Paul Krugman. And, jumping in now myself, and so, democracy be damned, the press, which is the propaganda organ of the establishment, democracy be damned, the press is clamoring for the Republican elders to get rid of this loose cannon, Donald Trump. Anyway, here on our 2016 Vice and Folly show, we will hear from better minds than my own on Donald Trump, on Hillary Clinton, and other public figures. And we'll turn from ridiculous domestic policies to ridiculous foreign policies in a minute. One more domestic item first. It's not an important story, but it says something about the mood of the country. Here's an item from the AP, December 26, 2015. Western New York man legally changes name to Darth Vader. Canandaigua, New York. A man changed his name to match the villain in the Star Wars films. The former Eric Welch of Canandaigua, New York, says he grew up in a series of foster homes and didn't have any strong ties to his name. The Star Wars fan says he chose Darth Vader for his new name because the movie character carries an aura of leadership and toughness. Thus spoke the Associated Press. Well, Mr. Vader's lot in life is not a happy one. The story also says he is trying to raise money to pay for a bone marrow transplant. So I wish him well. Still, to connote leadership and toughness, Darth Vader? Could have been worse, I guess. Still, if you are seeking to rename yourself to connote leadership and toughness, what name would I recommend? Good one. How about Albus Dumbledore? How about Nat Turner? Maybe Howard Zinn? Well, we've been talking about democracy in action and the efforts by both political parties to prevent it. How about a song to celebrate it? A new song by David Rovix, They Couldn't Stand By. At the moment, United States foreign policy consists to a good extent of unprovoked war and war crimes. That was the case in other days too, including the early 1970s. Then, we were pursuing a very large war against much of Southeast Asia, for no reason that made any sense, with no exit strategy, no possibility of winning, and at the cost of millions of innocent lives. On the plus side, it was good for business. The establishment and its mouthpiece, the press, were 100% firmly in support of this monstrous bloodshed. It was the average citizens of the United States, including many drafted soldiers and sailors, and some military officers, and millions of civilians. It was those guys who ended the war. The war ended when the American soldiers refused to fight it. The civilians refused to be drafted. Many refused to pay their war taxes. When millions took to the streets and refused to cooperate with the empire's evil criminal war. I was there. I remember. I remember the peace vigils, the marches, the draft card burnings. I remember the chants. 1, 2, 3, 4, we don't want your bleeping war. And also, hell no, we won't go. How about, hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? Those were heady times, and scary ones too. Incidentally, in 1968, the people were deceived by a Republican political scam artist, a con man who campaigned on ending the war and then, when elected president, did everything he could to prolong the war. That was Richard Milhouse Nixon. He was the guy who began the strategy of luring every redneck into the Republican Party. Nixon himself was a racist and an anti-Semite, too. So, If you want to condemn Donald Trump's several moral failings, be my guest. But don't single him out alone. Anyway, it was the average citizen, including rednecks, along with hippie dips, Black Panthers, small business owners, workers with blue collars, workers with white collars, and ordinary suburban housewives. You name it. It was the 99% who brought the establishment's evil war to an end. America should be proud, at least of that. Here's David Rovix.
It's a story everyone should know. It happened half century ago all across this sprawling nation. The rising of a generation. It started slow and then gained speed. Nobody knew where it would lead. First there were marches, then there were more. Way too many to keep score. They shut down classes, couldn't learn. Once they ascertained how napalm burned, they had to find out how to defy. People stood up because they couldn't stand by. There were parades held by the military brass. There were cities filled with CS gas. Real wars, war games, recruitment centers up in flames. Light a match, then in a flash, draft cards turned to ash. Thousands moved across the border, refusing military orders. Every army base in the USA had an anti-war cafe. There are times when you just can't comply. People stood up because they couldn't stand by. Soldiers insisted on free will, put down their guns, refused to kill. Newspapers of the underground ubiquitously could be found across the country, across the sea, throughout the ranks of the military. Take a grenade, pull out the pin. Praise be to Ho Chi Minh. Another fragging every night, a war that many refused to fight. Bombs were falling, some asked why. People stood up, cause they couldn't stand by. The ruling classes with all their powers shook inside their ivory towers. They were brought to their knees back then. That's why we don't have the draft again. Even back then, some of them knew they had to be careful what they tried to do. Rulers who miscalculate can lose control of their ship of state. In order to govern, you need consent. And all of that just up and went. In 68 came the reply. People stood up, cause they couldn't stand by. People stood up, cause they couldn't stand by. People stood up, cause they couldn't stand by.
So many of David Rovick's songs are little history lessons, and there's another. Let us widen our gaze from domestic policy disasters to foreign policy disasters. We'll have Glenn Ford speaking on our Syria policy in a few minutes. First, a nice essay by William Bloom. And before that, a really tiny little history lesson, courtesy of yours truly. Three countries in North Africa and the Middle East that had relatively progressive governments with good social welfare programs. Secular governments, not at all anti-US. Countries whose people had a higher standard of living than the region's average. Pretty good healthcare, pretty good education. Countries that had the best women's rights in the Arab world. And had governments that spent a good amount of the country's oil revenues and its other income on projects benefiting their citizens, such as healthcare and education. Countries that did everything they could to suppress extremist, radical, Islamist terrorist groups. What were these three lights under the Arab world? They were Iraq under Saddam Hussein, Libya under Muammar Gaddafi, and Syria under Bashar al-Assad. Are you sensing any pattern here? any pattern involving the U.S. foreign policy. And one of the creators of that pattern is named Hillary Rodham Clinton. Or so charges William Bloom in Counterpunch, March 11, 2016. I have edited and condensed his essay a little for radio. The title is American Exceptionalism and the Election Made in Hell, or Why I'd Vote for Trump Over Hillary, by William Bloom. Bloom writes, "If I were forced to choose between Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump, I would vote for Trump. My main concern is foreign policy. American foreign policy is the greatest threat to world peace, prosperity, and the environment. And when it comes to foreign policy, Hillary Clinton is an unholy disaster. From Iraq and Syria to Libya and Honduras, the world is a much worse place because of her. So much so that I'd call her a war criminal who should be prosecuted. And not much better can be expected from her on domestic issues either. Not from this woman who is paid $675,000 by Goldman Sachs, one of the most reactionary, antisocial corporations in the world. She was paid for 4 speeches, and paid even more than that in political donations in recent years. Earlier, while her husband was governor of Arkansas, Hillary was on the board of directors of Walmart for 6 years. Could anyone expect to change corporate behavior by taking their money? The Los Angeles Times recently ran an editorial which began, "Donald Trump is not fit to be president." The Times then declared, "The reality is that Trump has no experience whatsoever in government." But for me, when it comes to politicians, experience means nothing. The only thing that counts is the person's ideology. Who would you sooner vote for? A person with 30 years in Congress whose political and social views are the opposite of yours? Or instead, someone who has never held public office but is an ideological comrade on every important issue? Clinton's 12 years in high government positions carries no weight with me. The Times continues about Trump. "He has shamefully little knowledge of the issues facing the country and the world," quote unquote. But again, knowledge is trumped by ideology. As Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton had great access to knowledge. Clinton played a key role in the 2011 destruction of Libya's modern and secular welfare state, sending it crashing in utter chaos into a failed state. Until we overthrew him, Libyan President Muammar Gaddafi had been a leading foe of terrorists. With Gaddafi gone, Libya is now a haven for terrorists, from Al-Qaeda to ISIS. What good did Clinton's knowledge do? It was enough for her to know that Gaddafi's Libya would never be a properly obedient client state of Washington. Therefore, the United States, along with NATO, bombed the people of Libya almost daily for more than 6 months. They gave the excuse that Gaddafi was about to attack the Libyan city of Benghazi, and so the United States was thus saving the people of that city from a massacre. The American media, of course, parroted this story. Needless to say, no good evidence of the alleged impending massacre has ever been presented. Hillary Clinton championed the Western intervention in Libya. The New York Times credits her with convincing Obama to do it. The Times judged this, quote, "her moment of greatest influence as Secretary of State," unquote. All the knowledge that she was privy to did not keep her from this disastrous mistake in Libya. And the same can be said about her support of regime change in Syria. Rather than supporting the Syrian government in its struggle against ISIS and other terrorist groups, Even more disastrous was the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, which she, as a senator, supported. Both policies were clear violations of international law and the UN Charter. Another foreign policy success of Mrs. Clinton is the coup ousting the moderately progressive Manuel Zelaya of Honduras in June 2009. This is a familiar story in Latin America. The downtrodden masses finally put into power a leader committed to reversing two centuries of oppression. And before long, the military overthrows the democratically elected government, while the United States, if not the mastermind behind the coup, does nothing to prevent it or to punish the coup regime. Clinton's State Department quickly resumed normal diplomatic relations with the new right-wing police state, and Honduras has since become a major impetus for the child migrants currently pouring into the United States. And on the domestic front, Hillary Clinton has been a reliable conservative. During the 2007 presidential primary, the conservative magazine National Review ran an editorial by the prominent right-winger Bruce Bartlett. Bartlett forecast that the Democrats would almost certainly win the White House in 2008. What to do? Support the most conservative Democrat. Bartlett wrote, "It is pretty clear that Hillary Clinton is the most conservative." During the same primary, America's leading magazine for the corporate wealthy, Fortune magazine, put Hillary Clinton on its cover. The cover headline read, "Business Loves Hillary." And Mr. Trump? He is much more a critic of U.S. foreign policy than Hillary or Bernie. He speaks of Russia and Vladimir Putin as positive forces and allies. He would be much less likely to go to war against Moscow than Clinton would. Trump declares that he would be even-handed when it comes to resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as opposed to Clinton's boundless support of Israel. Trump calls Iraq, quote, "a complete disaster," unquote, condemning both George W. Bush and the neocons who surrounded him. Quote, "They lied. They said there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and there were none. And they knew there were none. There were no weapons of mass destruction," says Donald Trump. Trump even questions the idea that, quote, "Bush kept us safe," unquote, and adds that, whether you like Saddam or not, he used to kill terrorists. Yes, Trump is personally obnoxious. I'd have a very hard time being his friend. Who cares? Thus writes William Bloom in his very recent essay, "American Exceptionalism and the Election Made in Hell," or "Why I Vote for Trump Over Hillary." We have just enough time to hear Glenn Ford with an update on the U.S.'s war against Syria.
The 5-year-long U.S.-led proxy war against Syria is about to spiral out of control with possibly fatal consequences for the human race. The Obama administration's web of lies, intrigue, and relentless aggression has turned Syria into the world's most insane field of battle, where both the United States and Russia provide air cover to Kurdish forces that are being shelled by America's NATO ally, Turkey. Turkey has also been shelling units of the Syrian army, operating under Russia's protection. With 18,000 Turkish soldiers poised at the border, a Turkish invasion of Syria is considered imminent and will likely include Saudi Arabian troops and aircraft, all of which would become targets for Russian air defense systems the second they violate Syrian land and airspace. Should Turkey and Russia come to blows, which is entirely possible within the next few days, the Turks could block the Bosphorus Straits, closing off access to and from the Black Sea, bottling up Russian naval forces and provoking a world war. The Turks temporarily blocked the door to the Black Sea back in September after they shot down a Russian plane. Meanwhile, Western governments, their royal Arab allies, and the global corporate media scream for some kind of so-called humanitarian intervention in northern Syria, a transparent call for the United States to activate its so-called Plan B, an all-out U.S. military offensive against who? The United States will claim it's against the Islamic State. These days, the U.S. claims everything it does in Syria and in Iraq is part of the fight against the Islamic State. But of course, there never was a U.S. war against the Islamic State, which spread like wildfire until the Russian Air Force intervened in late September. The U.S., the Brits, the French, Saudi Arabia, and the other Gulf kleptocracies financed and armed all of the jihadist gangs that descended on Syria after 2011. And although the Islamic State decided that it had plans of its own, the American coalition never tried to militarily defeat ISIS in Syria or Iraq. ISIS was still useful to wear down the Syrian army and keep the Iraqi government off balance and dependent on the United States. The success of the Russian intervention changed all that. Under Plan B, the United States and its allies will move militarily to absorb the Islamic State and take over the Syrian territory that the jihadists now occupy, de facto dismembering Syria. The surviving ISIS fighters would fight on under U.S. protection, distributed among other jihadist groups and under new political labels. At least, that appears to be the plan. However, the Turks have their own agenda. Turkish President Recep Erdogan has staked his political life on defeating and humiliating the Kurds in his own country and in Syria. But the United States has made a huge investment in acting as the protector of the Iraqi Kurds in order to dismember and control Iraq, and the Americans are trying to play the same game with the Syrian Kurds. That's why the U.S. is providing air cover to some Syrian Kurdish units, while the Turks are shelling other Kurds who operate under Russian air cover 60 miles away. The Turks don't like the game the Americans are playing and are threatening to invade Syria, confront the Russians, and force the U.S. to choose between Turkey or the Kurds or World War III. This is a very dangerous moment for the planet. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
With that, we end our show entitled Vice and Folly at Home and Abroad. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimi non carborundum, question authority, stand up if you can't stand by, and please come back again next week. Ciao.